it is true that probably the first 20 to 30 assets are assets that were made for the game. So things like the sticks, all the terrain, the environmental terrain.
Yeah.
Many of those things were actually redone in some cases up to 3 or 4 times.
I think the stick was the one thing that wasn't right. Like this
is a good stick.
Yeah, the stick. Mm-hmm. The stick stuck around.
You know, some things are so perfect that they can't be improved upon.
Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 273 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm using the right microphone this time.
I'm Sam, and I've got long hair.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is August 21st, 20 Blundy. Before we get started, we have a warning. Anything could happen on this show, and there's going to be profanity. So know that that's coming. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. Thanks for letting us grab your money.
It was good.
If you'd like to support the podcast by letting us grab your money, go to moneygrab.bscotch.net. Let's talk about life. I want to talk about coffee.
What about it? What about it, Seth?
I'm 33. Okay. I'm a 33-year-old man.
I don't understand what this has to do with coffee, but yeah.
I'm that age where every now and then you'll see a news article about somebody just suddenly dying. And they'll be like, wow, he was only 32. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm starting to get to that point where I'm thinking like anything could kill me now. Just anything.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what's coming my way.
You've lost that youthful sense of indestructibility.
Yes. So pretty much ever since I can remember, I've had these random sporadic heart rate spikes. Okay. Like all of a sudden, just for like a minute, boom, like 150 BPM, just like, whew, mm-hmm. Really, really up there. But it would happen, you know, like once in 6 months or something like that. So I thought, you know, it's probably not a big deal. But I also drink a shitload of coffee. You know, I'm drinking a few real strong cups of coffee per day. And I started to think, you know, maybe these things are connected. Because just about anything can cause heart rate spikes. You know, if you go and look up, you're like, what could cause this? And you're like, I don't know, exercise, cancer, coffee, just being a person, alive. Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of hard to say, but I kind of thought, you know, maybe it's time to start, you know, making a little bit more healthy lifestyle choices.
Sure. Experimenting with whatever dials you got to see if you can get that to not happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, the easiest thing to do, and it, whenever you see the long list of things that it could be, just pick the thing that you could easily take action on and then, you know, see what happens.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I mean, I am drinking a lot of coffee and it has been like a fundamental staple of basically every aspect of my life for like probably since I was 21 or so.
Was it when you were studying for the CFA?
I started studying for the CFA exam is when I started drinking a lot of coffee.
That's how they get you.
I got locked in. But on Sunday, I just woke up and didn't drink coffee. And oh my God, it was a different experience. I was tired. I had to take a nap. I had a headache all day. And I didn't want to take Excedrin either because one of the active ingredients in Excedrin is caffeine. And like, that's what treats your headache. So I just kind of wrote it out. Monday was pretty rough, and I just kind of like have been slowly easing into it. But I just stopped, you know. You
went cold turkey.
And when I was talking to you and Adam about it earlier in the week, you guys had all of these ways, like all of these suggestions of like ways to transition, you know, out of it. But I just stopped. So which doesn't mean that it was easy. It was fucking hard, but it was very simple.
Yeah, well, I think we've talked about that on the show before about how you know, there's some of this false equivalence, I feel like, sometimes with whether it's, you know, dieting or changing up really anything about your life, which is the reality is it's always – oftentimes it's very simple conceptually.
Yeah.
It's like just eat less.
You want to quit smoking? quit smoking.
Yep.
Like, yeah, it's in the name. Yeah.
But yeah, the execution is so far from easy. It's easy. I think it's easier to get those two things confused when you're like, I feel bad about myself because I can't.
But also capacity to do the simple thing differs enormously by person, right? It's one of those annoying things where someone's like, well, I was able just to quit cold. I smoked for 10 years and then I just stopped. So why all these other fucking people can't quit? You know, it's like, well, that's not.
They're different people.
Surprise. They're different people. Yeah. Biology works differently. You know, everyone's in a different psychological state. I mean, because so for me, for caffeine, which I probably talked about in the podcast before, but I've had this endless battle since childhood because I had migraines as a kid and it was treated with caffeine. So I've just been on caffeine in some form or another basically since I was like 8 or something. And at various points in my life, I've tried to get off of it and I can't go cold because if I go cold, I just have migraines for a week, right? So I can't. Not physically possible for me. For other people, it's physically possible, so they don't have the migraines, but they're using it to also just as a psychological system, like as a safety net or whatever. Right? It's like that for me. Actually, it's a lot of it too. It's like the feeling of a hot beverage. It's the process of in the morning going through the motions of putting coffee together. Yeah. Right? There's a whole bunch of other stuff too. And if you just take all of that away. Then so I go for the substitution and the weaning approach where I try to substitute something else. Like so what works pretty well for me now is just substituting decaf coffee because like there's still some caffeine but it's way less. You still get all the rich. You still get everything except for just as much caffeine, right? Or I go through something that's just as laborious. And so I had this whole like 30-day weaning process using the instant coffee I mentioned a couple episodes ago, where I would measure it out by gram, in the morning. Yep. Just, and every like morning I would take a gram away. it started at like 40 grams or something. So I just like take a gram away.
Did you put them in little like tiny plastic baggies? And stuff?
Yeah. I had little bags in the whole thing. Yeah. And so every morning I would measure it out and I would just have 1 gram less every single day, just like weaning down. And I would substitute hot chocolate for what I had left. Otherwise, I was just drinking like kind of gross water, you know, by the end.
Yeah, you don't want that.
It's just terrible. But yeah, so I still – there was like still now a ritual involved. It was now a weaning of the caffeine. And so it actually worked really well and I was able to get completely off of it. But the thing that always brings me back to coffee is actually the ritual part.
Yes, so I think you know everyone's got their own style with this thing. And so for me, it's sort of almost a mix between the two methods, where I just have like one cup of coffee in the morning, and then I just have tea for the rest of the day. But switching to that was also done by using an instant coffee that I could measure the amount of, because I realized that kind of like what Seth experienced, that when I was making my own coffee at home through a French press, I don't know how potent that shit was every day, but like,
oh yeah, and it gets more potent over time too.
It gets more potent over time, and the range of it like just is flying all over the place. So now I just take a spoon and I just spoon out some instant espresso in a little tiny espresso cup, and that's it, right? And so that's my morning shot. And then once I go downstairs around like 11 or so, I'll make some black tea, and then I go green tea. So I sort of like transition the caffeine amount over the day, but always have a hot beverage involved, mm-hmm. Which is really what I care about.
Yeah, it really is just about having a nice hot cup of something, you know.
I got to have like
– that's kind of an interesting thing because, you know, my time in India, like it's hot there. It's just fucking hot in India. Well, not everywhere in India, but where I was in India. People are just downing tea, hot tea left and right. They're eating spicy food and they're washing it down with hot tea. And it's still like – it's somehow still pleasant.
Yeah. I know a lot of people when they go like in the middle of the summer when it's just fucking hot, you know, they like, go to, if they normally would go to, say, Starbucks to get coffee every once in a while, right, they switch over to in the summer. Now they're having iced coffees of various sorts. Mm-hmm. And I've never – like no matter how hot it is, I will never choose an iced coffee. It's always – like even like the whole thought of it. Like I don't even put the two ideas together that it's hot outside – and this coffee is hot. That's a bad thing. Like those aren't connected kinds of thoughts. It's just
completely unrelated.
Yeah, it's just I need coffee. Coffee is a hot.
Well,
beverage.
maybe when the earth has turned into a smoldering cinder 20 years from now, you'll be like, you know, I'm gonna switch to iced coffee.
Possible. No, it's just completely changed.
Now it's time. Yeah, it's gotten hot enough that it's time. So Sam, I think you've got a scone. We got some kind of scone update.
Yeah. So you know, 2020 has been the morning walks where my wife and I go and eat scones, right? And this is now we're deep in. This is like 6 weeks in. I'm pretty sure
you're in the clutches of big scones.
Oh yeah, 3 to 5 days a week when that shop is open, we're I'm there. You know, I'm there in the morning. Get up in the morning, go for a little bit of a walk, and then stumble into there like a, you know, like an addict, getting my scone fix, get that lemon blueberry scone, and just go for it. Okay. Now they're delicious. Don't get me wrong. It's all good. But I'm starting to see the effects of consuming a scone every single day, you know, on my midsection. Okay.
Oh.
So I mentioned to my wife the other day, I was like, yeah, I'm feeling a little fat. And she's like, nah, you're looking great. You're looking great. And I was like, I think I could tell, like, there's a little something going on, you know, like a little more than the usual. So I think I need to, you know, back off the scones. And then we're, you know, so she, I think there's the interesting sort of rule about like being someone's partner, right? Which is because people are people, like, you're, you know, you'll sort of fluctuate about how you feel about your own appearance, right? And your partner's job is oftentimes to just sort of try to maintain the level and be like, no, like, you're fine. You're still, you're the same as you've been, right? Unless it's the case that, you know, maybe you've actually gone off the deep end on something, but you need a hard knock. But for the most part, I feel like the job is to kind of, you know, keep people even. So she was doing that for me. It was great. We go in the bathroom and then I'm looking at mine. I'm like, oh, yeah, definitely something. And then she looks at hers and she's like, oh yeah, I think I'm getting fat. And I just go, oh no. It's sort of like unthinkingly, because I was like, brush my teeth, just kind of do this thing. And then she just looked over at me, and then both of us just like burst out laughing because she was like, that means that you agree. So we just sort of like lost it, which I think is one of those funny, weird social contracts you have, right? Which is like what the role of a partner is when it comes to not necessarily just the fitness thing, but as far as like being that supportive wedge, and how every so often, if you're sort of caught off guard, then you have this sort of break of the agreement, which ends up being, in our case, very funny. Because I think,
but it was still supportive in the sense that you both felt that you were going through the same thing, but neither of you wanted to admit it.
It wasn't until
both of you started talking about it that it kind of broke through.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, yep, you know what? We're getting scone belly.
Yeah, we're getting scone belly. It's 2020. So yeah, I think it was one of those things where being slightly distracted by brushing my teeth made it so I wasn't there. I wasn't 100% ready. So I just reacted.
Yeah, you got to focus on those molars. You got to really get back in there.
Yeah. I don't want to have to go to the dentist during 2020. You kidding me? I'm brushing these things.
Like, I got a text from my dentist and they're like, hey, you going to be coming in? And I was like, no.
Yeah. I go, no, I'm mine. Not. Yeah, I was like, no, I'm not coming in. And they're like, we would have appreciated, that you, if you would have called in or canceled. Like, you know.
And I was like, it's like, hey, I would have appreciated a lot of things, yeah, you know, right now at this point in 2020. But I didn't get those things.
This is what electric toothbrush is for. With an electric toothbrush, you just don't need the dentist. That's what my experience. Every time I go, they're like, your teeth are really clean. Why do your gums bleed so much? Because like, it looks like you're flossing. I'm like, just electric toothbrush.
Yeah, see, I brush a manual, you know, so I'm more of a manual brusher. That's why I have to go to the dentist still. It actually sucks. Like the, you know, toothbrush hijacking doesn't happen anymore to me because like – it's a manual, you know. No one even knows how to use it.
Nobody knows how to drive that thing. Uh-huh.
So
they pick it up and they're like, how do I put this thing in reverse?
Can't figure it out.
I've been starting to try to figure out how to brush my dog's teeth, you know.
Ooh, yeah. We got one of those finger gloves. Did you get what you got? The weird finger glove thing?
No, I got this really wild toothbrush. I'm going to try to verbally walk you through what this is like. Okay. A normal toothbrush is a stick with a flat plate on the end. And bristles coming up vertically off of the flat plate, right?
Uh-huh, with you.
Okay, a dog toothbrush, stick, a V-shaped plate with bristles coming inward at a 45-degree angle.
So you can go down the line of the teeth with it?
Yeah, so you can catch both sides of the teeth in one – so you can catch both sides and the bottom of the tooth in one go. And I'm looking at this and I'm like, why the fuck do dogs get this technology?
Their mouth opening goes backward along the ridge of the teeth. So like as a person, you only have this hole facing forward.
What kind of teeth do dogs have?
They have a combination.
They got all the kinds.
Do they have molars and everything?
They have a modified canine that's a molar.
But it's still all really pointy shit, right?
They got super pointy little tiny ones in the front.
Yeah.
Then they've got giant fangs.
Yeah, the canonical canine.
Yeah, and then they've got molars kind of like ours, but not quite as flat. Like their molars are kind
of – it's very much –
I wonder how much – because with our teeth, most of our teeth are just like very – they have extremely flat surfaces, you know? So I feel like it makes sense that we use another flat thing to scrub them. But if dogs have really pointy surfaces, it feels like it makes sense to – to, you know like how those like automatic knife sharpeners and stuff, they're also just like a V, you know, and you just like run the knife through it. So it's basically the same concept, I think.
Yeah, but for some reason, I was laughing so fucking hard because I finally got the dog under control, you know, and she was kind of chilling, and I have like this special toothpaste, and it's kind of minty, you know, which is very unfamiliar to a dog.
Yeah, it's a weird choice.
And for some reason, it just cracked me up where like I finally got to a point where I had the toothbrush in her mouth and it was like behind her cheek. And she was just standing there and I was like brushing and it just sounded like a person brushing the teeth. So she was just sitting there just kind of like exasperatedly looking off in the distance and it was just like I don't know why. It was just fucking hilarious.
It's hilarious. It was just great.
I'm only getting like three teeth a day here because it's just like that's too much, and then she's
yeah. Out, that's how nail trimming works for the cats. It's like whenever they fall asleep next to me, I just like go in and I snip like 3 to 5 nails, you know, because that's the most I can get.
Mm-mm. Yeah, so you know, pets, they bring a lot of entertainment, but also a lot of misery sometimes.
Speaking of, we need that cat update, Adam. Where are we at?
Give us a cat update. Cat gate.
It's been several weeks since we talked about it, but we finally made one breakthrough where the newest edition and the oldest edition, I guess the oldest one, are now getting along. So that only took a million fucking years, but they are now finally like playing with each other. There's still some hissing and, you know, that bullshit here and there, but they're not trying to kill each other. They're just playing most of the time. So we can have them just in the same space for most of the day. So it's an exception right now because now I'm podcasting. So I just took the kitten because the fucking kitten can get anywhere, just can get anywhere. And so if I'm going to have one cat, it's got to be her basically, because otherwise she will end up here. Then I'll have two and then they'll be doing shit. And I'm trying to record a podcast and then the whole thing.
Yeah.
So we made that breakthrough and our other cat, the one who's the problem child is, we're just coming more to believe that he's got two things happening at the same time. He's got some sort of underlying health issue. Don't know what it is, but he's like itchy all the time. He's like always blinking one eye. Like there's a lot just kind of going on. And he's clearly just anxious. So it's that combo of things now that seem to be the cause for all the other problems, that like the social fabric problems, you know? So we don't know what to do about those yet. We've been going through this fucking insane headache because part of his stuff is that he just refuses to eat stuff. And so it's been really hard to feed him. There's a really good chance that his medical stuff is a food thing, like a food allergy of some sort. So the ways that you treat that are with basically this horrible food called hydrolyzed protein, where it's you just hydrolyze as in like you cause a reaction in between every protein, every amino acid molecule, so that there's nothing interesting there. It's just a soup of amino acids. So you're just
giving him
right?
mush, basically.
So it's just mush. It's like it has no taste. It's like but he won't eat anything though. So we're like, he's not going to fucking eat this. So that's one way we can try to treat it. Because then you do that for a while, then you see if all the symptoms go away, right? The other one is you go on a single protein because it's a cat, right? So single protein diet where you try to find foods that have only one kind of animal guts in them. Right. So we opted for that one because we're like, there's not a chance in hell we're going to be able to even eat. And we already had him lose so much weight one time that we had to put him on a drug that makes him stimulates his appetite. So we did it like on this search, trying to find foods that he hasn't eaten yet. So that it's unlikely that's the thing he's allergic to. Right. But that only has that one food in it. And if you ever looked at the back of an animal food can or a human food can.
Yeah, they're just like, I don't know. We just
– Yeah, it's like whatever the fuck we had on hand, we just throw it in. Just like if you've never read the ingredients of your pet's food, it's insane. It's like the first ingredient is like – it's like chicken, turkey, pork. They like list every animal that there is and everyone is just like miscellaneous parts, right? Mm-hmm. So we've been on this quest for trying to find this fucking food and it is nightmarish, very expensive. And it led to all these questions because apparently salmon is a common allergen. And so then we see like there's fish oil in there, all these fucking things. We're like, what kind of fish? So then we're like sending emails to the companies who make these food being like, what kind of fish is this?
That's true. There's a lot of kinds of fish.
There's a lot of kinds of fish.
I assume the oil isn't, you know, the same across.
Yeah. And there's also many of them also just label meat byproduct, right? So we've had to just avoid those ones completely because what kind of meat? What kind of meat the fuck is in there?
You know, meat.
Yeah. So we've now been trying – so we've landed on basically duck and rabbit because those are like ones that aren't normally in cat food, you know? Mm-hmm. So we were like trying to find duck and rabbit foods.
High class.
He's a very fancy fucking boy. And then even further, it was so hard to find like canned food or dry food that just had those things in it. We did find like some, but then we've been also going for weirder stuff because there's apparently like raw foods for cats is a whole thing. But of course, they go bad really fast. So the way that you get them is as freeze dried little like spaceman food, you know, like nuggets that you then rehydrate. And so we've just tried thing imaginable. It's been quite the journey.
Well, in this cat's defense, if you are itchy, if you are blinking constantly, if you're kind of just enraged and not feeling good, I feel like I would also be attacking literally everyone. I remember
it makes sense. Yeah.
What was that steroid I was on for the cancer stuff? The one that makes everybody like lose their shit. Prednisone. Yeah.
Prednisone, yeah.
Oh my God. Like I was on a super high dose of that. And yeah, there were some times I just had to sit there as quiet as I could be at the dinner table. Cause like we went out to eat at like an Indian restaurant and I was literally just like, I was completely enraged and there was nothing happening. I had no reason to be enraged. I was just like sitting there and I was just like, just mad, just so mad.
You know, like, this is kind of a weird tangent, but I'm gonna take it. Something I've been thinking about is people talk about like, oh, it'd be so interesting if you could like upload your consciousness into a machine, like into a computer, mm-hmm. or make like a robot brain or something. But if you take away the wild soup of gooey hormones, who the fuck are you?
Yeah.
100%. You know? Cause like if you can be completely enraged for absolutely no reason, while just having a nice family dinner, simply because there's some kind of weird, you know, tweak in the soup of your brain, right?
Oh, this implies this idea implies that if you were to make a computerized version, that there's two kinds of things. There's like the stuff that comes from like hormones or whatever, and then there's like your actual brain or something, and we're uploading that part instead of saying
that's what I'm saying.
But they're not different though. But it's not even different like in terms of how you would model it. Because if you want to try to model a brain so you can upload it, your brain is just also a pile of it's a soup of chemicals, right? So the addition of hormones is just one of the subset of all the chemicals doing stuff. So I don't think you could. I think you would still just – if you're going to model a brain, you would also be modeling the hormones mm-hmm. that interact with
you'd
it.
Have to.
You'd have to. So you could be a bodiless brain in a machine completely enraged for no reason.
Yeah, because it's like, who are you?
That's the
goal.
And
the answer is, well, it depends. You know, who am I if I haven't had coffee for 3 days? Who am I when I'm tired? Who am I when I've woken up and I'm jazzed to get ready for the day? Uh-huh. You know, I'm a different person at all these times. And it's all because of soup.
Absolutely.
Brain soup. Well, good luck on your cat journey.
Yeah. So yeah, I feel like we're getting into a good spot, but these stupid, like, nondescript health issues, you know, which of course people have too, right? Where it's just
it's hard.
I just feel bad all the time. That's my thing, right? And then you go to a doctor and they're like, okay, well, it could be any of these three dozen things. And then it's hilarious because like I remember my wife, since she used to be a pediatrician, she would come home and talk about like the annoying things that she would see like other physicians doing, where they would say like, oh yeah, we're gonna need you to do this with your kid because your kid is sick, right? And then without taking into account how hard it is to do certain things with kids, like feed them terrible tasting drugs or, you know, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And that's actually such a bad problem that in a lot of residency programs for pediatrics, the residents actually have to taste – they do medicine tasting so that they know when they prescribe something to a kid, like how bad of an experience it's going to be, so that they can have that on their radar as they're doing
something. You know, I always said that all my oncologists needed to get a bone marrow biopsy.
Yeah, exactly.
They were so cavalier. They're like, we're going to send you down for a bone marrow biopsy. I was like, I had one 3 weeks ago. They're like, yeah, we'll just do another one. We'll check in. And yep. I'm like, fucking no.
We'll just do one more. We'll just stab you right in the bone.
It feels like you're pulling my leg through my backside.
Yeah, like, totally. And I feel like this, like with vets, like there's, at least with many vets, there's none of that. They're just like, oh yeah, your cat's going to, it's like when our chronically sick guy had a Giardia for a while. And they're like, oh yeah, you're going to need to feed him 3 doses a day of these 2 different horrible tasting liquid drugs, right? For 2 weeks. Like that's what I had to do. It's like, there has to be a different way, right? There's got to be some other mechanism for this. Because the additional that like stress that adds, and like that it's a challenge every morning. It's then now it's a wrecking the fragile, you know, safety net between like me and this cat, like the whole thing. And they're just like, oh yeah, this is like, you just go do this. Or when they're talking about food stuff, they're like, oh yeah, you're gonna have to put him on this diet that he's not going to want to eat, for at least 30 days. Cause that's how long it takes to tell. I'm like, there has to be something else. Right? There has to be some other way to do it.
There've been times where I go to the vet for something with my dog and they'll be like, okay, so she's got this condition. She's going to need either you can give her these giant antibiotic pills.
Yeah, or we can give her
every
a shot.
2 weeks. Right. Here's all the rules about how to administer them. Like, she can't have it with cheese. She has to eat it with food. You have to make sure she swallows it, blah, 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 blah. And she also hates it and won't want it.
Yep.
Or we'll just give her an injection right now and then it's fine.
Yep.
I'm like, why the fuck? Why are you even giving me the options? Yep. Yeah, that's crazy. All right. Anyways, let's talk about the studio.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Crashlands 2. So we need to talk about some imposter syndrome stuff. But first we need to talk about our hilarious accidental Crashlands 2 reveal this week. So here's the thing. We have our policy of trying to get games onto as many platforms as possible, right? And one of the fundamental things that we're getting on board with is DevOps, this idea of continuous deployment, always like making builds of things and getting them out, right? So we've started some of the preliminary work on Crashlands 2, and one of the early things we need to do is create the different like back end pages.
So your product IDs and stuff, so that this, as we make builds, they actually, you know, they go get delivered to wherever the back.
So we want it to be the case that, like, as we're working on even these early prototypes, we are deploying those prototypes to Steam and, you know, wherever else, right? So that we can test them internally, because a lot of these platforms have internal test tracks. So these are not meant to be public things. These are just like, we're just getting the infrastructure set up. The Google Play backend is constantly changing. The documentation is very disconcerting at times. And so this week we were getting our Crashlands 2 page set up for Google Play. And again, this is like, we don't even have a game yet. This correct. Is like,
there's no
just
game.
Getting. Yeah. Yeah. And so we're getting this thing set up, and we found that, like, in order to like be able to test the game internally, we also needed to quote publish.
And by discovered this, we mean that the Play Store interface literally just said that.
It said
you must publish this in order to test or to put it in the internal track or whatever.
And so when we were looking back at our Levelhead stuff, we realized we had run into this problem with Levelhead also, where we ended up with Levelhead, we needed to publish just some version of the game. And it didn't need to be like a fully public one. It could be like a publish into like a closed beta or whatever. And we did that with Levelhead, and we just set the price to $99 so that nobody would buy it. And then we just pulled it down, right? Mm-hmm. So that way, like, it had been published, and now our internal test track was open, and now we could actually test the damn thing. Again, this is insane, but this is how this works. But this, as far as we could tell, this is how this works. So we did the same thing with Crashlands 2. It was up for
a day,
like a half a day, mm-hmm. For $99. We had just reused like old screenshots from old Crashlands. And then the application that we had uploaded was literally just an empty game maker project. Like, we just needed something, right? So it's just like a black screen. And just with that, all of a sudden there's a hubbub. There's somebody noticed. There's people in the Android gaming subreddit talking about it. Mm-hmm. Android Police comes out.
Actually funny that they're called the Android Police. Site. Think about it.
Yeah. Yeah. So they spotted it. They start writing an article. They do this like investigative journalism piece where they're speculating like, how could this be? What does it mean? And then they go through and they found like some old Reddit thread that I had written. And they did this deep dive into trying to figure out what was going on with this thing. Right. And we look at this and we're like, damn.
That's great.
That's great. I guess. And actually, somebody in the Android gaming subreddit actually bought. They actually paid the $99. Like, we put it at $99 so that people wouldn't buy it. And somebody bought it anyway, just to see
what it was.
And it was just a black screen, and then they just refunded, right? But yeah, I mean, it was an interesting like accidental market test where we've been kind of on the fence. Like, do people care about this? Is this really the thing we want to be working on right now? And just the fact that a store page existed with the Crashlands 2 name on it for half a day was enough for us to get even a single article. We were like, okay.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that
it feels like paid right track there.
If someone paid $99 so they could maybe get to see it early, I was like, okay, I'm here for that.
okay.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things.
Let's talk about
it. Well, yeah, what we're trying to do is really, when it comes to Crashlands 2, what we've done so far is just a lot of this pre-production work that we've been talking about here and there with the overall design. And now we're starting to crack into some of the visual development stuff. And what's come alongside that is this idea of consistently market testing the game, whether it's the initial pitch, the initial structure of the design, and then also getting into market testing the art. And so what's been funny about this is I've actually like on my sort of target, there's literally a first target of a market test, which is some form of like an announcement or, you know, something like that to test the waters and see if anybody gives a shit. And I've been sort of musing the back of my head about how exactly to do that. And that's, you know, that's months off because we don't have anything we want to share exactly yet with it. But I've been musing my head about exactly how to do it and like, oh, it's kind of tricky because we want to have like, what do we have lined up first? And then this just like happened on Wednesday. And I can't tell you how pleased I was because I was like, great. Like, I didn't have to do anything. And then we got exactly the result that I would like, at least, you know, from the ecosystem that this thing was planted in, right? Which is the Android one. So that was really fun. It was really fun to see, even though it was a sort of a freaky accident, which, you know, wouldn't recommend happening on purpose to anybody, but good yeah. to happen. And then as far as where we're at on the project, so we're just kind of continuing along this pre-production phase. So like I said, prototyping has sort of just barely begun. We're still wrapping up all this tech debt stuff. But one of the interesting things that's happened is, you know, I think people who've been listening to the show for a while will know that as far as the art goes, that I really only got into art for real about 2 years ago. Actually, they're sort of in the middle of the early stages of Levelhead. So when I first, which I think is weird to say.
No, it's when you move from doing it because you had to doing it because you wanted to and also had to.
Correct. And so since then, I've taken, I think, four or five classes. Been basically doing pretty consistent studies weekly for just trying to figure stuff out, see how things work, doing some animation testing, whatever. And so, yeah, as we step into Crashlands 2, it's still going to be a 2D, but I'm really trying to figure out. I'm trying to push everything so that I can, you know, when someone looks at it, the whole goal is if someone looks at your game and they're just like, yes, I need it. I need it. I will pay $99 for it. Right. And so that's the market I'm trying to hit. And so one of the interesting things that's happened though is one is that I feel like a few of the recent pieces that I've done internally as we've been working on the biz dev have been good, where they've been nailing a sort of a feel and a look. And the weirdest thing about that though has been the secondary feeling that comes afterward, which is I'll make one and I'm like, yeah, I think this is good. And I show it to everybody and they're like, yeah, this is good. And then afterwards I'm like, okay, I did one. Is that the only one that I was like, is that the one?
Is it the piece? Only good thing I'm
yeah, like is that am I gonna be able make? To cause like you know, over the course of a project, you know, Levelhead, we've talked about how many art assets are in there. And same thing for the original Crashlands actually. There's a fuckload of art. Like just a tremendous amount of art that goes into these things. And it's the same with the programming and everything else. But I think at the start of a project before, it's sort of like getting a few of those early pieces done is weird because at least for me, I'm trying to punch above where I have previously understood my skills to be. And so anytime you manage to land one of those things, and again, it's like one of the first times you've done it, then I think this question kind of starts eating at you a little bit, which is like, is this replicable? Like over the course of 500 more assets, right? Can I deliver at this level?
Well, I think actually, to me, that is even quite imposter syndrome. I mean, it is a little bit because the sense of like you clearly could do it once, so why couldn't you do it again, right? Mm-hmm. But I think there's actually this is more about where you are in your learning how to do this kind of art, right? Because when it came to Levelhead, you'd been leveling up all your skills the whole time, but you didn't change styles. You didn't change tools, right? Mm-hmm. You changed aspects of your process approach and you added some new steps of like sketching steps and that kind of thing. And even those, as you were doing that stuff at the beginning, you felt a lot more uncertain about, right?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And I think this is one of those experience things, which is you're talking about this as if the fact that you've been making even just good art for a long time means that now when you're making a new kind of art, you should just be like, look, I can do it. So this should be fine, right?
Right.
But you're really talking about – you're now in this actually new realm of uncertainty, which is, as you said just a moment ago, like you've made one or whatever, like a tiny number of good assets with this new style. And when you did – when you brought those to us each time, you were extremely uncertain about if it actually was good, right? And also you got way more feedback than usual about all the things that weren't as good, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's a new style. So you're feeling it out. You don't actually know how to gauge what is and isn't good. Like, I think it's actually at this stage, it is completely fair for there to be huge amounts of uncertainty in terms of like whether or not things are good, because you've changed so much in one go and all of it is unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. And I think as you start to make more assets, I think what we're going to see here is that the first, I don't know, like a couple dozen assets are going to be riddled with this like doubt and uncertainty, right? And I think also you're going to remake all couple dozen of those assets like five times, right? I think is what's going to happen. And then once we get on the other side of that, you're going to end up now back in that state you were like in the middle of level head development, right? Where, yeah, there's always some imposter syndrome. There's always some uncertainty involved. But for the most part, you're just going to be working on stuff, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. Because actually, if we think back to old Crashlands days, it is true that probably the first 20 to 30 assets are assets that were made for the game. So things like the sticks, all the terrain, the environmental terrain.
Yeah.
Many of those things were actually redone in some cases up to three or four times.
I think the stick was the one thing that wasn't right. Like
the good stick.
Yeah, the stick. Mm-hmm. The stick stuck around.
You know, some things are so perfect that they can't be improved upon.
Yeah, it was like the platonic idea of the stick.
It's honestly true though, because like that was one of the first things that I made in that game that looked good, which is so funny, so dumb to say, but like literally it's a stick with like a, you know, like it's like your classic twig, you know, it's like a single line and then a broken off sort of you know, branch point. And for some reason, I was like, this is a good stick. And
it's a good stick. It was a good stick.
Yeah, but everything else got remade. And if you think about it too, towards the end of development, like it was really hard for you to not go back and remake everything again.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the position to take at this phase is like to try to flesh out the style, but not necessarily go for perfection, right? Because the quality comes with reps,
right?
Yep.
Right. And so it's going to be more about filling out the game, this early phase of the game with lots of content, feeling out the style, and then going back and revising some of the earlier
things. Yeah, and I think in programming, I think the assumption should be when you complete an asset, like in particular at the beginning. That you just assume this is actually a prototype of the, even no matter how good it is, no matter how much you think, even when it's done, you're like, oh yeah, this is now the character, right? The assumption should be that by the time you've now finished out like the, you know, like a draft of the biome. So it's like, you've now got real terrain in there that you've maybe swapped out a couple times too. You've now got like the plants that you expect. You got like a building now, like you have enough in there that now you look at Flux or whatever, you know, you look at the character right in that context and you say, does this still make sense? Does this still track now that the story has moved a little bit? Does it feel like this character's design reflects the sort of attitude and what's going on with this thing? Now that we've discovered, like now that we've experimented with this other mechanism,
gameplay,
this different gameplay mechanic or whatever, does the animation requirements change? Yeah, because there's going to be so much that's going to be changing as we do this. I think we have to continuously avoid being in a production mindset. Just completely avoid it until we have actually confidently locked down everything, where we say, okay, we actually know. We know the mechanics. We know all this. We know the story. We know everything. We prototyped all of it. We've redrafted the code a bunch of times. We've redrafted the art a bunch of times. We feel like we now know what this thing is. And then we flip from pre-production into post-production. Production. Then production. Right. And then we just – and now it's a matter of just being like, we know what this thing is. Now we make it. And we make the thing as it's supposed to be. If in the end, 3 months later, we're like, oh, we don't like this thing as much. Too fucking bad. We're in production. We have a million more things to make, right? We have to just keep on moving. This is the time where we just get to experiment and just decide what actually is good and what good means, what the vibe is and all of that.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting because all this stuff is so circular at the beginning, because it's very circular. You're putting down the first, you know, points in the sand for what this thing is supposed to look like, right? And so the reality is that every single one of those that you put down, I'm sure, so anybody who listens to the guys, like I think anytime you're working on a creative problem, or actually if you're just doing problem solving, oftentimes this is what happens, which is you make a small inroad somewhere, and then that causes you to have to go sort of rethink the previous structure of the thing because that now exists, right? And so this early phase is that's basically where we're at, and that's happening on all fronts sort of simultaneously. It's happened a lot with the design already, but we're sort of moving into the biz dev phase. And so I guess, yeah, makes sense that there's just a lot of like, is it good?
Is it good?
Can
is
I
it...
even do this again? I don't know. I'm just burning my
dick. I think it's fine to think that like, no, like that's a perfectly reasonable thought right now, because right now is the exploratory phase where you're trying new tools, trying new approaches, trying new art styles, trying new animation, trying new everything. And it would be wild if you like sat down, banged out a new character for the game, which is the thing that a player will look at for, you know, 1,000 hours, hopefully, right? And be like, yeah, I just fucking nailed that.
Right? Nailed that in one.
This is the thing we're going to have forever. And I knew all the questions ahead of time somehow. I knew everything. And so I made this to exactly fit the entire reality of what this game will become in 3 years or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is – I think it kind of speaks to – we've always had that position that like you can't plan stuff, and I even made a GDC talk about it. We're trying to plan more this time, but it's not really planning so much as we're trying to anticipate in advance some of the questions that we will stumble across through the iterative process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think right? The idea is plan at the right time. If you plan when everything is a question, then you don't have a plan. You just have – a random bullshit hypothetical thing you made up, right?
Right.
If you have all the questions answered, if you know what the questions are and have answered all or most of them, right, then now you can design a solution, which I feel like is different than – because to me, plan always means like I've predicted the future. Like to me, that's what the – as a word, that's what that feels like it means, right, versus like design or solve or whatever, right, where it's like I've identified the suite of problems. Now I just have to like do the work of putting the solution together, right? Yeah, so I feel like that's kind of the difference in how I think about this.
But it is pretty fun, and actually there was a YouTube video that was it Mark Brown?
Yeah, from Game Maker's Toolkit.
Game Maker's Toolkit put out about the idea of games designing themselves, right? And there's so many iconic games out there like Rocket League or Tribes, you know, where the core thing that makes the game what it is was discovered accidentally. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Anyway, we even had this with Levelhead with the grappling hook, right? Like without that, I don't know what the game would be, but it would definitely not be what what it turned out to be. I think
the idea there is that if you do have that separate, isolated prototyping phase where you're learning all of this stuff and you know, and discovering all of these things, and you just separate that, because if you're doing this during production, because basically that's where the cost comes from, right? If you're doing this during production, which is historically how we've always done it, then the costs are really high, because your cost to make every asset, to write every line of code, everything now is really, really high, because the requirements are higher. The fidelity has to be spot on the whole time, right? And so every time you now discover a new thing as part of that process, the cost to actually weaving that new thing into the bigger picture is fucking enormous.
I kind of disagree though, because it sounds like you're sort of laying down a line in the sand of saying like, we've answered all the questions that we're going to answer. Now we're in production. But the fact is like so many things can only be discovered once you have all the pieces in place and you mm-hmm. actually have a game that you are in production on. And then you realize, oh my God, this like once we have all these systems in place, there's this aspect of it that comes together to form this emergent gameplay thing that we didn't really.
And so you don't think know. That all of that already should have been in place in the prototype?
That's what's supposed to be done.
The difficulty is you can prototype a lot of things, right? But prototyping every single game system to the point where you have all of the content that makes the game systems work. It's very hard to figure out where the line is between that being a prototype and just being the game.
Oh yeah, yeah. I would never think that once you sat down to actually like move into the production phase that you would just be like, okay, we're on rails now. Like this is going to be trivial. We just like do the work and we're done. But the idea of that phase is doing as much work as possible ahead of time when it's cheap, while things are not being made, you know, quote unquote, for production. The fidelity is lower.
Yeah, it's the difference between I think pumping the game full of content versus figuring out the systems. So that's
yeah.
On a high level.
Yeah, so figure as, like, get as much content as you think you need in there in order to understand the things that or in order to discover the things that may come up. Nothing more, right? Yeah, exactly. Right. So you do. So unlike say in Levelhead, where as soon as we wanted to have an enemy, we made like six enemies in one go, right? So we didn't have the opportunity to answer questions about what does it feel like to have enemies, right? Like what kinds of interesting new questions come out as a consequence of having an enemy or an enemy or those, of like the two types that we think might with be interesting.
The game modes. You know, we spent a good amount of time on those game modes.
We didn't even have one functional game mode, and we had four non-functional game modes at the same time. Yeah, exactly. It's that kind of thing. Yep. It's like you don't need to do that, right? And I think that's the lesson that we learned or that we're trying to have learned, because it's very easy to get very excited about something and just start to make it, right? I think it's all about like how do you answer as many questions as possible as cheaply as possible and give yourself the opportunity to discover the things that you don't know or even questions yet, all before you really just are doing extremely costly development work.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And it's hard to answer that because, you know, it's complicated.
Yep.
But we're trying. All right. So I think it's about time for us to get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.beastgotch.net. Highest upvoted question comes from Chelosis. Chelosa says, what's the worst home improvement project you ever tried to do? Oh, man. I mean, most of them. Each one is worse than the last, probably.
It's one of those things where I think because you oftentimes haven't done it before, you don't even know what all the suite of things are that could go sideways, so you can't prepare effectively enough. So it's always going to be one of those, like, I went back and forth to Home Depot like four times to solve this one silly problem because I don't know anything about it.
Yeah. I've landed firmly in the camp of not solving my own home improvement problems.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at too.
Mm-hmm. But even in that case, you can still have stuff go sideways. I mean,
if somebody else is improving your home, that can go pretty wrong.
Yeah, but at least it's going sideways on their time, you know?
It's true. Mm-hmm. Like, what about your door that you just got fixed finally?
Yeah, that went pretty sideways.
Yeah, it did, but you know. It didn't really affect my life, right? Like we said, like, we need a new door. We take the time to just like order it. It shows up with a hole drilled through it. So we're like, well, that's not right. But it was through Home Depot. Mm-hmm. So we had the person come and he installed it. And of course the door's all like in a box and stuff. So we don't know that it has a hole through it until it's out of the box. Yep. And we're looking at it and we're like, honestly, this is still an improvement over the door that we currently have. So, because the door we had didn't close. Mm-hmm. It just didn't close, right? Which is like one of the core functions of a door. So I was like, you know what we'll do? We'll get this door installed because the guy's here. The door is here. All the pieces are in place. The plan is underway. We'll install the door. And then I just I rolled up the hole wasn't too big. It's like the size of a finger, right? So I just rolled up a paper towel real tight, stuck it in there, snipped it off at the ends, and then taped over it. I'm like, boom, hole is insulated for now. No bugs are getting in that hole.
Yep.
And then we contacted Home Depot about it, and then they sent us a new door and a new person to install it. And that was that, right? But like, it took 20 minutes for like my part in this whole thing.
It took
20 minutes, right? And the same thing, like a tree branch. We had this big storm. Tree branch fell on our roof, and it dented our gutter. So our gutter had like a V shape, right? And I'm looking at this, and I'm like, man, fuck. Now my gutter's dented. Am I going to get on a ladder, climb up there, try to figure out? Like, I don't know. I don't know how the fuck to undent a gutter. I've never, ever conceived of this problem or how to fix it. And I don't have any of the knowledge, right? So I just call some gutter people and they come and they undent my gutter and also they clean it. And also they put a guard on top of it. So now like leaves and shit can't get in there. Boom. Took me again, 15 minutes.
Right? Yeah. I think main errors come from when you try to do it yourself. Cause like in our case, it was definitely, I think I told the story before on the podcast.
The deck.
Yeah, you guys fucked that up real good. Well, my wife's like, yeah, it'll be super easy. And then we go get all the stuff, start working on it. And 4 hours later, have like, a, you know, just the smallest little patch of it done. And it's hot and terrible. And I'm like looking at all of the surface area for the first time on a deck and realizing just how much there is because there's four sides to every pole. and like the top, the side, whatever, the whole thing. And I was just like, this is terrible. And then we call someone to fix it and they come out and they're like, nah, like you guys did such a terrible job that we literally can't put our name on it. Literally, that's what they say. And I'm like, what is happening? This is horrible. I hate it. And then end up having to get like some random handyman dude to do it who does like the most medium job imaginable. But again, like Seth said, kind of like having a door with a smaller hole in it. I like
the
idea
that you did such a bad job that the only people willing to touch it were also people who would also do a bad job. Yeah. Just to get it done. So it's done.
Yeah, now. I asked him. I was like, so are you saying that I need to like have this done poorly and then wait like 4 or 5 years for the finish to like wear off and then call you guys? And he was like, yes. Okay. All right, buddy.
But think about what this – I mean with home improvement projects, so like our generation – we have a hard time getting homes, right?
Correct.
Like they're all owned already and they're expensive. So we don't – we aren't like the generation from – you know, who grew up in like the 50s and 60s.
You bought a house for $5 and
– you're like, hey, I turned 18. I've been flipping burgers for 6 hours. It's time to buy a house, right?
Mm-hmm. I paid for my college too already while flipping those burgers for 6 hours.
And also like the economy was different at that time where people did do most of their own home improvement projects, mm-hmm. right? And so like people grew up helping with those projects around the house and then they had their own house immediately. There was no like middle apartment stage or some bullshit. So nowadays, there are people who can come fix your shit at a reasonable rate. And also usually it's your landlord because you're in an apartment for 15 years.
You're not allowed to fix things yourself.
Yeah. So like the idea that I would like buy a house and then suddenly just be able to do drywalling or like shit that I've never had to do, never thought about doing, never conceived of is wild. And then just the fact that if I make – like you're, like what you experienced, Sam. If I make a mistake
– it can be very expensive.
Yeah. If I make a mistake, literally the first time I've ever done this thing
– which is guaranteed.
Then it's like boom, hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars.
Just it's more cost effective just to hire somebody out of the gate.
Yeah. You know? And so that's – you know, I did – I think there was like one thing I tried to do where I tried to like put these coat hangers on the wall. But for whatever reason, the drywall anchors and like the thing is, I know how some of these things work, right? So I'm putting in the drywall anchors, but the drywall anchors that came with the hooks were some kind of weird cheap thing where like I started screwing them into the drywall and they just ripped in half, except they're now like half of them is stuck in the drywall. Yep. Well, the only way you're going to get that out is by drilling a bigger hole. And now you can't put a drywall anchor in because there's a giant hole in the wall, right? Mm-hmm. So I ended up just with a bunch of holes in my wall. And then I had somebody come patch that hole and then repaint back over it. And that was the end of it. I don't have coat hangers.
the entirety right? of my you know, quote unquote home improvement projects is basically putting things on into walls, right? And in our house it's an old house. It was built in 1895 or some crazy thing.
Mainly brick, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all brick. And so it's brick on the outside. Then the interior now is like whatever has happened for the past 130 years, right?
Right.
And so every time I go to a wall, you just don't know what's going to be back there. It's 120 years of stuff, right? It's behind every wall. And so I've got all the things. I've got my stud finder. I've got various kinds of instruments for trying to detect what's behind the wall, right? It turns out that all those are just horseshit as far as my experience has been. And so I'll be like moving across a wall to like it'll blink in this spot and then in this spot. I'm like, okay, cool. So I like I know kind of where things are. So then I go around those things and I go through and then suddenly like I hit a fucking junction box or I hit a vent or an air duct, I mean, right? And so there was this like a 9 month period where there were just two holes in our bathroom wall that both just one that hit a junction box and one that hit air vent air ducts because like I drilled into them because thinking there was nothing there after using my magic technology, you know, mm-hmm. And in both cases I just bumped into those things and they were right behind the drywall, so I couldn't use that to mount anything. So then I just had holes there. I was like, I don't want to patch this. So
it's just two tiny holes.
So then like literally just like 9 months later, I finally, you know, but it's like, that's been my whole experience. When we tried to hang up those, one of those closet kits that you get from Container Store, you know, And it was the same fucking deal. Like, so my wife found the perfect spot in her office. And so she got the thing size, like we got it all in. And I went up to put it up. And then sure enough, two of the fucking four holes for like the top mount thing just hit things behind it. And both of them it was another air duct, right? And one is like right behind it. There's like a quarter inch of free space. And the one, like, there was like a whole half inch of free space. And so then I'm over here being like, okay, well, I got a Dremel, right? So I'm like, I'm cutting the screws shorter to try to like figure out if I can make stuff fit. Go to the hardware store and buy like four kinds of different drywall anchors.
I think this is why. Like,
one of these is going to work. Like, and I eventually did do it, but I'm very suspicious about one of those anchors and what it's actually doing. But I figure 3 out of 4 is pretty good.
I think it's the thing, right? It's like you go to hang something on the wall and the amount of things that can go sideways, not just the painting itself, but
it's
like
a nightmare.
Just putting something on the wall is too damn high.
Yeah, it is the case. Every time we've done something interesting, like we had all of our toilets replaced when we moved in to like ones that weren't 1,000 years old and sucked, you know? I mean, that did suck, but in a powerful,
the correct way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of them, when we replaced it, the guy ended up having to be, because it's like, it's a simple thing. And like, in principle, yeah, I could replace a toilet. Gross. Not interested.
Simple is not easy.
Simple is not easy. So we have so the guy's up here doing it. He did the first, because we like replaced everything. So he did like, in like an hour, he'd like replace four fixtures, like two toilets and two sinks, right? He goes up to do the last one. 6 hours later, after him having to go out and buy some wood and like do all this kind of stuff, because it turned out that underneath the old one, like, it was literally just resting. Like, the thing that was holding it up was the pipe below it. It like wasn't resting on anything. The floor wasn't holding up. It was just fucking sitting on a pipe. And so he'd come down after he discovered this, and he was like, he's like, I could just put something back on there, but I feel like this is bad. I was like, yes, this is bad. Just like just fix this shit. And so then, yeah, so then 6 hours and like $1 jillion later, we get that thing fixed, right? So it is the case. Like, every time you poke behind something with house stuff, it's just like it becomes a bigger and bigger nightmare. So my strategy has been to avoid it whenever possible and then hire really good experts and then when I think I can afford to do it, and otherwise let things be shitty for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this reminds me of all throughout this week, we've been working on shoring up some of the last pieces of this tech debt stuff. And we'll be like, okay, time to do this super simple thing, right?
There's always some fucking thing.
We got to do it, and then 9 things go wrong, and we're like, oh, wait a minute. And then as you fix those things, you discover there's 9 other things that are fucked up. Yeah. And the theme from this week was, man, it's always some fucking thing. It can never – there can never not be some fucking thing.
You can't just hang a picture on the wall, you know? You can't.
Yeah, I think there's been maybe like – of all the things that I've stuck into walls over my lifetime, I think like 3 or 4 of them were seamless. It was just like, poked a hole, perfect. The hole didn't, nothing was back there. Everything worked out great. I didn't misalign anything. Like, everything's great. Put a thing, it's been like 2 toilet paper hang like rack thingies and like a towel bar. I think that's the entirety of my pure success with home improvement project. Even like, I was getting into woodworking a few years ago, and now it's just too hot and I haven't been able to do it. But I was like learning stuff and like fucking up, because like it's part of learning, right? Which, as Seth was saying, you can't just go suddenly become a house magician, right? So, but I was like, I'm going to learn some woodworking stuff. So I was playing with things, and I built my own like woodworking desk thing, you know, and I was like super pumped about it. But I kind of fucked up a little bit where some of the boards weren't like misaligned, but they were like somewhere like a little raised relative to each other. So it was just kind of a little, it wasn't a perfectly flat surface. But I'd also got this cool electric planer, you know, which I was very excited about. And so I was like, oh, I can just fucking just like plane it, you know, just like get rid of that height. Having never used this thing before, right? And so I go to do it. And then now it's like this crazy, like hideous monstrosity. Like, I turned the thing that was like a minor problem into now like a piece of shit. Because
it's like a hole through it, basically.
Well, it's basically because I just like planed across it, and then like, but you can't like perfectly get these things to line up after you've gone across once. And so now, instead of a thing that has like these like smooth edges where each board is just like a slightly different, you know, height coming up, now the 3 boards in the front all have like 3 grooves across them at different heights with sharp edges, and it's just it's just stupid.
I think this is why command strips were so successful.
Oh god, command strips are fucking great. Yep.
Because you're just like, cool, I can put whatever I want on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I know what that is, you know?
But think about the marketing there, because literally all you're doing is taping something to the wall, you know? Like, that's what it
– yeah, but it's a real good tape.
It's real good tape, and it's not super likely to pull your paint off. It's like – it's likely to keep the thing hanging there. So it's not likely to fall off. When you decide you want to get rid of it, it's not likely to rip the paint off. In my experience, paint still comes off pretty fucking frequently.
Just saying, if any Command Strip sponsors are out there, I mean, we got you if you want to
– Oh, yeah. I haven't really heard them sponsoring podcasts.
But new market opportunity, you know.
What is the it seems like there's some products that you literally only hear about on podcasts.
I think it's anything targeting millennials.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's just because if you think about a podcast, as far as like being able to target an audience, like you know exactly what a person is about by what podcast they listen to. You know what I mean? Like it's not as vague of a thing as like, oh yeah, we're going to like show an ad during, I don't know, like
the Super Bowl.
Yeah, the Super Bowl or some shit, because like everybody participates in these things. But if you're like, okay, yeah, we're going to show our ad to people who are listening to Butterscotch Shenanigans comedy podcast, which is all about game dev. Like, you know exactly.
You mean it's a little bit about game dev.
It's about 15% about game dev.
Yeah.
I think it's also about command strips. Mm-hmm. So, 100%. Command strip. Who makes those? 3M?
They make everything with sticky stuff.
They make everything sticky.
But it is a case of that. I think because of all these like medium to bad experiences trying to do very simple things with household stuff, like my go-to now is to not do a thing first, because like I'm already stressed out just thinking about all the possible things. Like my wife's been wanting to hang stuff. Like we've lived in this house now for 4 years, something like that, right? We have no art on any wall. Just nothing, right? Because every time we talk about doing it, I'm like, but once we start, there's going to be a fucking hole in this wall and it's not going to work because it's going to turn out there's something back there that we can't poke a thing through. Now there's a hole in this wall. Now we're going to have to patch that shit or just like hang something even higher. Now this is going to be not misaligned with everything else that we've hung. It's going to become a nightmare. And like, I'm already stressed out. I don't want to do it. So that is, yeah, that's
– Yep.
That's all you do. Command strips, Adam.
You just got to paint your walls nice colors, which we did do.
We made that also. Our walls are not boring, just sort of – out of the gate. Otherwise, yeah, command strips. Command strips are great. And even like we were putting a sewing table for my wife together. So she like bought an IKEA, one of those big like cube, what do you call them? Cube bookshelf thingies. It's just like, you know, six little cube slots. So it's like a big thing. And then bought just like a tabletop. And we're like, okay, we just need to stick these together. That was going to be the problem, right? And so like we get these things home and I'm knocking on the thing. I'm like, oh, fuck, this thing's hollow, right? It's like, what's going to happen if I try to like just screw these together? Because it's made out of basically cardboard, you know? So I was like, oh, I don't know what to do here. And then I had bought these like really powerful just Velcro mounting tape things. And I was like, what if we just fucking Velcro this to
the – Just tape them together.
And it's amazing. And actually it's like – I didn't realize like Velcro is strong as shit when you got a bunch of it. That thing like it kind of wobbles a bit but only a tiny bit. But if you want to get it off, it is really – because we had to take it off once too. It was like so hard to get off, but you still could take it off. You know, which is pretty rare.
You literally you're just describing a command strip again. So
I know. Exactly. It's just a command. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's a 3M product too. So yeah, so 3M.
Tape it together. We're already, we'll just take our sponsorship check in the mail.
Yep.
You can just send that on over. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Coster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, just go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to, everything. So thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Goodbye.